Agnes waited with the others for the curtain to go up. She was one of the crowd of 50 or so townspeople who would hear Enrico Basilica sing of his success as a master of disguise, it being a vital part of the entire process that while the chorus would listen to expositions of the plot, and even sing along, they would suffer an instant lapse of memory afterwards, so that later unmaskings would come as a surprise. For some reason, without any word being spoken, as many people as possible seemed to have acquired very broad-brimmed hats. Those who hadn't were taking every opportunity to glance upwards. Beyond the curtain, Herr Trubelmacher launched the overture. Enrico, who had been chewing a chicken leg, carefully put the bone on a plate and nodded. The waiting stagehand dashed off. The opera had begun. Mrs. Plinge reached the bottom of the grand staircase and hung on to the banister, panting. The opera had started. There was no one around, and no sounds of pursuit either. She straightened up and tried to get her breath back. "Cooey, Mrs. Plinge!" Nanny Ogg, waving the champagne bottle like a club, was already travelling at speed when she hit the first turn in the banister, but she leaned like a professional and kept her balance as she went into the straight and then tilted again for the next curve, which left only the big gilt statue at the bottom. It is the fate of all banisters worth sliding down that there is something nasty waiting at the far end. But Nanny Ogg's response was superb. She swung a leg over as she hurled downwards and pushed herself off, her nailed boots leaving grooves in the marble, as she spun to a halt in front of the old woman. Mrs. Plinge was lifted off her feet and carried into the shadows behind another statue.
"You don't want to try and outrun me, Mrs. Plinge," Nanny whispered as she clamped a hand firmly over Mrs. Plinge's mouth. "You just want to wait here quietly with me. And don't go thinking I'm nice. I'm only nice compared to Esme. But so is practically everyone."
With one hand tightly around Mrs. Plinge's arm and the other over her mouth, Nanny peered round the statue. She could hear the singing far off. Nothing else happened. After a while, she started to fret. Perhaps he'd taken fright. Perhaps Mrs. Plinge had left him some sort of signal. Perhaps he decided that the world was currently too dangerous for ghosts, although Nanny doubted he could ever decide that. At this rate, the first act would be over before... A door opened somewhere. A lanky figure in a black suit and a ridiculous beret crossed the foyer and went up the stairs. At the top, they saw it turn in the direction of the boxes and disappear. "You see," said Nanny, trying to get the stiffness out of her limbs, "the thing about Esme is, she's stupid." "So she thinks that the most obvious way, do you see, for the ghost to get in and out of the box... is through the door. If you can't find a secret panel, she reckons it's because it ain't there. A secret panel that ain't there is the best kind there is, the reason being no bugger can find it. That's where you people all think too operatic, see? You're all cooped up in this place, listening to daft plots what don't make sense, and I reckon it does something to your minds. People can't find a trapdoor, so they say, 'Oh, dearie me, what a hidden trapdoor it must be!' Whereas a normal person, e.g. me and Esme, we'd say, 'Maybe there ain't one then.' And the best way for the ghost to get around the place without being seen is for him to be seen and not noticed, especially if he's got keys. People don't notice Walter. They looks the other way." She gently released her grip. "Now, I don't blame you, Mrs. Plinge, 'cause I'd do the same for one of mine. But you'd have done better to trust Esme right at the start. She'll help you if she can." Nanny let Mrs. Plinge go, but kept a grip on the champagne bottle, just in case.
"What if she can't?" said Mrs. Plinge bitterly. "You think Walter did those murders? He's a good boy."
"I'm sure that's the same as a no, isn't it?"
"They'll put him in prison."
"If he done them murders, Esme won't let that happen," said Nanny.
Something sank into Mrs. Plinge's not very alert mind.
"What do you mean she won't let that happen?" she said.
"I mean," said Nanny, "that if you throw yourself on Esme's mercy, you better be damn sure you deserve to bounce."
"Oh, Mrs. Ogg."
"Now don't you worry about anything," said Nanny, perhaps a little late under the circumstances. It occurred to her that the immediate future might be a little bit easier on everyone if Mrs. Plinge got some well-earned rest.
She fumbled in her clothing and produced a bottle half full of some cloudy orange liquid.
"I'll just give you a sip of a little something to calm your nerves."
"What is it?"
"It's a sort of tonic," said Nanny.
She flicked the cork out with her thumb. On the ceiling above her, the paint crinkled.
"It's made from apples. Well, mainly apples." Walter Plinge stopped outside Box 8 and looked around. Then he removed his beret and pulled out the mask. The beret went into his pocket. He straightened up, and it looked very much as though Walter Plinge with the mask on was several inches taller. He took a key from his pocket and unlocked the door, and the figure that stepped into the box did not move like Walter Plinge. It moved as though every nerve and muscle were under full and athletic control. The sounds of the opera filled the box. The walls had been lined with red velvet and were hung with curtains. The chairs were high and well padded. The ghost slipped into one of them and settled down. A figure leaned forward out of the other chair and said,
"You can't have my fish eggs."
The ghost leapt up. The door clicked behind him. Granny stepped out from the curtains.
"Well, well, we meet again," she said.
He backed away to the edge of the box.
"I shouldn't think you could jump," said Granny. "It's a long way down."
She focused her best stare on the white mask.
"And now, Mr. Ghost."
He sprang back onto the edge of the box, saluted Granny flamboyantly, and leapt upwards. Granny blinked. Up until now, the stare had always worked.
"Too damn dark," she muttered. "Grebo!"
The bowl of caviar flew out of his nervous fingers and caused a Fortean experience somewhere in the stalls.
"Yes, Granny. Catch him, and there could be a kipper in it for you."
Grebo snarled happily. This was more like it. Opera had begun to pall for him the moment he realized that no one was going to pour a bucket of cold water over the singers. He understood chasing things. Besides, he liked to play with his friends. Agnes saw the movement out of the corner of her eye. A figure had jumped out of one of the boxes and was climbing up to the balcony. Then another figure clambered after it, scrambling over the gilt cherubs. Singers faltered in mid-note. There was no mistaking the leading figure. It was the ghost. The librarian was aware that the orchestra had stopped playing. Somewhere on the other side of the backcloth, the singers had stopped too. There was a buzz of excited conversation and one or two cries. The hairs all over his body began to prickle. Senses designed to protect his species in the depths of the rainforest had adjusted nicely to the conditions of a big city, which was merely drier and had more carnivores. He picked up the discarded bow tie and, with great deliberation, tied it around his forehead so that he looked like a really formal kamikaze warrior. Then he threw away the opera score and stared blankly into space for a moment. He knew instinctively that some situations required musical accompaniment. This organ lacked what he considered the most basic of facilities, such as the thunder pedal, a 128-foot earthquake pipe, and a complete keyboard of animal noises, but he was certain there was something exciting that could be done in the bass register. He stretched out his arms and cracked his knuckles. This took some time, and then he began to play. The ghost danced along the edge of the balcony, scattering hats and opera glasses. The audience watched in astonishment, and then began to clap. They couldn't quite see how it fitted into the plot of the opera, but this was an opera, after all. He reached the centre of the balcony, trotted a little way up the aisle, and then turned and ran down again at speed. He reached the edge, jumped again, soared out into the auditorium, and landed on the chandelier, which jingled and began to sway gently. The audience stood up and applauded as he climbed through the jangling tiers towards the central cable. Then another shape clambered over the edge of the balcony and loped along in pursuit. This was a stockier figure than the first man, one-eyed, broad in the shoulders and tapering at the waist. He looked evil in an interesting kind of way, like a pirate who really understood the words Jolly Roger. He didn't even take a run, but when he reached the closest part to the chandelier, simply launched himself into space. It was clear that he wasn't going to make it. And then it wasn't clear how he did. Those watching through opera glasses swore later that the man thrust out an arm which merely seemed to graze the chandelier, and yet was then somehow able to swivel his entire body in mid-air. A couple of people swore even harder that just as the man reached out, his fingernails appeared to grow by several inches. The huge glass mountain swung ponderously on its rope, and as it reached the end of the swing, Grebo swung out further like a trapeze artist. There was an appreciative "Ooh!" from the audience. He twisted again. The chandelier hesitated for a moment at the extremity of its arc, and then swept back again. As it jangled and creaked over the stalls, the hanging figure swung upwards, let go, and did a backward somersault that dropped him in the middle of the crystals. Candles and prisms were scattered over the seats below. And then, with the audience clapping and cheering, he scrambled up the rope after the fleeing ghost. Henry Lawsey tried to move his arm, but a fallen crystal had stapled the sleeve of his coat to his armrest. It was a quandary. He was pretty sure this wasn't supposed to happen, but he wasn't certain. Around him he could hear people hissing questions. Was that part of the plot? I'm sure it must have been. Oh, yes, yes, it certainly was, said someone further down the row, authoritatively. Yes, yes, the famous chase scene. Indeed, oh, yes, they did it in Querm, you know.
Oh, yes, of course, yes, yes, I'm sure I heard about it.
I thought it was bloody good, said Mrs. Lawsey. Mother, about time something interesting happened. You should have told me. I'd have put my glasses on.
Nanny Ogg pounded up the back stairs towards the fly loft. Something's gone wrong, she muttered under her breath as she took the stairs two at a time. She reckons she's only got to stare at them and their toffee in her hands, and then who has to sort it out afterwards, eh? Go on, guess. The ancient wooden door at the top of the stairs gave way to Nanny Ogg's boot, with Nanny Ogg's momentum behind it, and cracked open to a big, shadowy space. It was full of running figures. Legs flickered in the light of lanterns. People were shouting. A figure ran straight towards her. Nanny sprang into a crouch, both thumbs on the cork of the badly shaken champagne bottle she held cradled under one arm. "This is a magnum," she said, "and I'm not afraid to drink it." The figure stopped. "Oh, it's you, Mrs. Ogg." Nanny's infallible memory for personal details threw up a card. "Peter, isn't it?" she said, relaxing. "The one with the bad feet?" "That's right, Mrs. Ogg. The powder I give you is working, is it?" "They're a lot better now, Mrs. Ogg." "So what's been happening?" "Mr. Salzella caught the ghost."
"Really?"
Now that Nanny's eyes had managed to discern some order in the chaos, she could see a cluster of people in the middle of the floor around the chandelier. Salzella was sitting on the planking. His collar was torn, and a sleeve had been ripped off his jacket, but he had a triumphant look in his eyes. He waved something in the air. It was white. It looked like a piece of skull.
"It was Plinge," he said. "I tell you, it was Walter Plinge. Why are you all standing around? Get after him."
"Walter?" said one of the men doubtfully.
"Yes, Walter!"
Another man hurried up, waving his lantern.
"I saw the ghost heading up to the roof, and there was some big one-eyed bastard going after him like a scalded cat."
"That's wrong," thought Nanny. "Something wrong here."
"To the roof!"
shouted Salzella.
"Hadn't we better get the flaming torches first?"
"Flaming torches are not compulsory."
"Pitchforks and scythes?"
"That's only for vampires."
"How about just one torch?"
"Get up there now, understand?"
The curtains closed. There was a smattering of applause which was barely audible above the chatter from the audience. The chorus turned to one another.
Was that supposed to happen?
Dust rained down. Stagehands were scampering across the gantries far above. Shouts echoed among the ropes and dusty backdrops. A stagehand ran across the stage holding a flaming torch.
"Here, what's going on?"
said a tenor.
"They've got the ghost. He's heading for the roof. It's Walter Plinge."
"What? Walter? Our Walter Plinge?"
"Yes."
The stagehand ran on in a trail of sparks, leaving the yeast of rumour to ferment in the ready dough that was the chorus.
"Walter? Surely not. Well, he is a bit odd, isn't he?
But only this morning he said to me, 'It's a nice day, Mr. Sidney.' Just like that, normal as anything. Well, normal for Walter.
As a matter of fact, it's always worried me, the way his eyes move as though they don't talk to each other."
"And he's always around the place."
"Yes, but he's the odd job man."
"No argument about that."
"It's not Walter," said Agnes. They looked at her.
"That's who we said they're chasing, dear."
"I don't know who they're chasing, but Walter's not the ghost. Fancy anyone thinking Walter's the ghost," said Agnes hotly. "He wouldn't hurt a fly. Anyway, I've seen."
"He's always struck me as a bit slimy, though."
"And they say he goes down into the cellars a lot. What for, I ask myself? Let's face it, fair's fair. He's crazy."
"He doesn't act crazy," said Agnes.
"Well, he always looks as though he's about to. You must admit it. I'm going to see what's happening. Anyone coming?"
Agnes gave up. It was a horrible thing to learn, but there are times when evidence gets trampled and the hunt is on. A hatch flew open. The ghost clambered out, looked down, and slammed the hatch shut. There was a yowl from below. Then he danced across the leads until he reached the gargoyle-encrusted parapet, black and silver in the moonlight. The wind caught at his cloak as he ran along the very edge of the roof and dropped down again near another door. And a gargoyle was suddenly no longer a gargoyle, but a figure that reached down suddenly and twitched off his mask. It was like cutting strings.
"Good evening, Walter," said Granny, as he sagged to his knees.
"Hello, Mrs. Weatherwax."
"Mistress," Granny corrected him. "Now stand up." There was a growl further along the roof, and then a thump. Bits of trapdoor rose for a moment against the moonlight. "It's nice up here, ain't it?" said Granny. "There's fresh air and stars. I thought up or down, but there's only rats down below." In another swift movement, she grabbed Walter's chin and tilted it, just as Grebo pulled himself onto the roof, with prolonged murder in his heart. "How does your mind work, Walter Plinge? If your house was on fire, what's the first thing you'd try to take out?" Grebo stalked along the rooftop, growling. He liked rooftops in general, and some of his fondest memories involved them, but a trapdoor had just been slammed on his head, and he was looking for anything he could disembowel. Then he recognised the shape of Walter Plinge as someone who had given him food, and standing right next to him, the much more unwelcome shape of Granny Weatherwax, who had once caught him digging in her garden and kicked him in the cucumbers. Walter said something. Grebo didn't take much notice of it. Granny Weatherwax said, "Well done. A good answer. Grebo?" Grebo nudged Walter heavily in the back.
"Want milk right now. Brrr, brrr."
Granny thrust the mask at the cat. In the distance, people were running upstairs and shouting.
"You put this on, and you stay down real low, Walter Plinge. One man in a mask is pretty much like another after all, and when they chase you, Grebo, give them a run for their money. Do it right. There could be..."
"Yeah, I know,"
said Grebo despondently, taking the mask. It was turning out to be a long and busy evening for a kipper. Someone poked their head out of the stricken trap door. The light glinted off Grebo's mask, and it had to be said, even by Granny, that he made a good ghost. For one thing, his morphogenic field was trying to reassert itself. His claws could no longer even remotely be thought of as fingernails. He spat at the pursuit as they poured up the steps, arched his back dramatically on the very edge of the roof, and stepped off. One story down, he thrust out an arm, caught a windowsill, and landed on the head of a gargoyle, which said,
"Oh, thank you very much,"
in a reproachful voice. The pursuers looked down at him. Some of them had managed to get hold of flaming torches, because sometimes convention is too strong to be lightly denied. Grebo snarled defiance and dropped again, springing from sill to drainpipe to balcony, and pausing every now and again for another dramatic pose and another snarl at the pursuers.
"We'd better get after him, Corporal de Nobbs," said one of them, who was staggering along behind.
"We'd better get after him by carefully going back down the stairs, you mean? 'Cause something I drank don't want to stay drunk. Much more running and I'll be dropping a custard, I'm telling you."
The other members of the posse also seemed to be reaching the conclusion that there was no extended future in chasing a man down the sheer wall of a building. As one mob, they turned and, shouting and waving their torches in the air, headed back to the stairs. The parting crowd revealed Nanny Ogg holding a pitchfork in one hand and a torch in the other, and thrusting them both in the air while muttering, "Rhubarb, rhubarb!" Granny walked over and tapped her on the shoulder.
"They've gone, Githa. Rhubarb!
Oh, hello, Esme," said Nanny, lowering the implements of righteous retribution. "I was just tagging along to see it didn't get out of hand. Was that Grebo I saw just then?"
"Yes."
"Oh, bless him," said Nanny. "He looked a bit bothered, though. I hope he doesn't happen to anybody."
"Where's your broomstick?" said Granny.
"It's in the cleaner's cupboard backstage."
"Then I'll borrow it and keep an eye on things," said Granny.
"Hey, he's my cat. I ought to be looking after him," Nanny began. Granny stepped aside, revealing a huddled shape sitting hugging its knees.
"You look after Walter Plinge," she said. "It's something you'd be better at than me."
"Hello, Mrs. Ogg," said Walter mournfully.
Nanny looked at him for a moment.
"So was he the..."
"Yes."
"You mean he really did do the murder?"
"What do you think?" said Granny.
"Well, if it comes to it, I think he didn't," said Nanny.
"Can I have a word in your ear, Esme? I don't reckon I should say this in front of young Walter."
The witches bent their heads together. There was a brief, whispered conversation.
"Everything is simple when you know the answer," said Granny. "I'll be back soon."
She hurried off. Nanny heard her shoes clattering on the stairs. Nanny looked down at Walter again and held out her hand. "Up you get, Walter."
"Yes, Mrs. Ogg."
"I expect we'd better find somewhere for you to lie low, eh?"
"I know a hidden place, Mrs. Ogg."
"You do you?" Walter lurched across the roof towards another trapdoor and pointed to it proudly. "That," said Nanny, "that doesn't look very hidden to me, Walter."
Walter gave it a puzzled look, and then grinned in the way a scientist might, after he'd solved a particularly difficult equation.
"It's hidden where everyone can see it, Mrs. Ogg."
Nanny gave him a sharp look, but there was nothing but a slightly glazed innocence in Walter's eyes. He lifted up the trapdoor and pointed politely downwards.
"You go down the ladder first, so I will not see your drawers."
"Very kind of you," said Nanny. It was the first time anyone had ever said anything like that to her. The man waited patiently until she had reached the bottom of the ladder, and then climbed laboriously down after her.
"This is just an old staircase, isn't it?"
said Nanny, prodding at the darkness with her torch.
"Yes, it goes all the way down, except at the bottom where it goes all the way up."
"Anyone else know about it?"
"The ghost, Mrs. Ogg," said Walter, climbing down.
"Oh, yes," said Nanny slowly. "And where's the ghost now, Walter?"
"He ran away."
She held up the torch. There was still nothing to be read in Walter's expression. "What does the ghost do here, Walter?"
"He watches over the opera."
"That's very kind of him, I'm sure." Nanny started downwards, and as the shadows danced around her, she heard Walter say,
"You know, she asked me a very silly question, Mrs. Ogg. It was a silly question. Any fool knows the answer."
"Oh, yes," said Nanny, peering at the walls. "About houses on fire, I expect."
"Yes. What would I take out of our house if it was on fire?"
"I expect you were a good boy and said you'd take your mum," said Nanny.
"No, my mum would take herself."
Nanny ran her hands over the nearest wall. Doors had been nailed shut when the staircase had been abandoned. Someone walking up and down here with a keen pair of ears could hear a lot of things. "What would you take out then, Walter?" she said.
"The fire."
Nanny stared, unseeing, at the wall, and then her face slowly broke into a grin. "You're daft, Walter Plinge," she said.
"Daft as a broom, Mrs. Ogg," said Walter cheerfully.
"But you ain't insane," she thought. "You're daft, but you're sane. That's what Esme would say. And there's worser things." Grebo pounded along Broadway. He was suddenly not feeling very well. Muscles were twitching in odd ways. A tingling at the base of his spine indicated that his tail wanted to grow, and his ears definitely wanted to creep up the sides of his head, which is always embarrassing when it happens in company. In this case, the company was about 100 yards behind, and apparently intent on moving his ears quite a long way from their current position, embarrassment or not. It was gaining, too. Grebo normally had a famous turn of speed, but not when his knees were trying to reverse direction every few seconds. His normal plan, when pursued, was to jump onto the water butt behind Nanny Ogg's cottage and rake the pursuer across the nose with his claws when it came around the corner. Since this would now involve a 500-mile dash, an alternative had to be sought. There was a coach waiting outside one of the houses. He lurched over to it, pulled himself up, grabbed the reins, and briefly turned his attention to the driver.
"Get off!"
Grebo's teeth shone in the moonlight. The coachman, with great presence of mind and urgent absence of body, somersaulted backwards into the night. The horses reared and tried to break into a gallop from a standing start. Animals are less capable of being fooled than are humans. They knew that what they had behind them was a very large cat, and the fact that it was man-shaped didn't make them any happier. The coach lumbered off. Grebo looked over his twitching shoulder at the torch-lit crowd and waved a paw derisively. The effect pleased him so much that he clambered onto the roof of the swaying coach and continued to jeer. It is a cat-like attribute to spit defiance at the enemy from a place of safety. In the circumstances, it would have been better if cat-like attributes had included the ability to steer. A wheel hit the parapet of the brass bridge and scraped along it, the iron rim kicking up sparks. The shock knocked Grebo from his perch in mid-gesture. He landed on his feet in the middle of the road, while the terrified horses continued on with the coach, rocking dangerously from side to side. The pursuers stopped.
"What's he doing now? He's just standing there. There's only one of him, and there's lots of us, right? We could easily overpower him." "Good idea. On the count of three, we'll all rush him, right? 1, 2, 3.
Pause.
"You didn't run."
"Well, nor did you."
"Yes, but I was the one saying 1, 2, 3. Remember what he did to Mr. Pounder?" "Yes, well, I never liked the man all that much."
Grebo snarled. Ticklish things were happening to his body. He threw his head back and roared.
"Look, at worst he'd only be able to get one or two of us. Oh, that's good, is it? Here, why is he twisting round like that?
Maybe he hurt himself falling off the coach.
Let's get him!
The mob closed in. Grebo, struggling against a morphogenic field swinging wildly between species, punched the first man in the face with a hand and clawed the shirt off another man with something more like a giant paw.
Whoa, sure!
20 hands grabbed him. And then, in the melee and the darkness, 20 hands were holding just cloth and emptiness. Vengeful boots connected with nothing more than air. Clubs that had been swung at a snarling face whirled through empty space and returned to hit their owner on the ear. Quite unnoticed in the scrum, a flat-eared bullet of grey fur shot out from between the scuffling legs. The kicking and punching stopped only when it became apparent that all the mob was attacking was itself. And since the IQ of a mob is the IQ of its most stupid member divided by the number of mobsters, it was never very clear to anyone what had happened. Obviously, they'd closed in on the ghost, and he certainly couldn't have escaped. All that was left was a mask and some torn clothing. So, the mob reasoned, he must have ended up in the river, and good riddance too. Happy in the knowledge of a job well done, they adjourned to the nearest pub. This left Sergeant Count Detritus and Corporal the Count de Nobby Nobs, who lurched to the middle of the bridge and regarded the few scraps of cloth.
"Commander Vimes isn't going to like this," said Detritus. "You know he likes prisoners to be alive."
"Yeah, but this one would have been hung anyway," said Nobby, who was trying to stand upright. "This way was just a bit more democratic. A great saving in terms of rope, not to mention wear and tear on locks and keys."
Detritus scratched his head.
"Shouldn't there be some blood?" he ventured.
Nobby gave him a sour look.
"He couldn't have got away," he said, "so don't go asking questions like that.
Only, if humans is hit hard enough, there leaks all over the place," said Detritus.
Nobby sighed. That was the calibre of people you got in the watch these days. They had to make a mystery of things. In days gone by, when it had been just the old gang and an unofficial policy of laissez-faire, they'd have said a heartfelt, "Well done, lads," to the vigilantes and turned in early. But now old Vimes had been promoted to commander, he seemed to be enrolling people who asked questions all the time. It was even affecting Detritus, considered by other trolls to be as dim as a dead glowworm. Detritus reached down and picked up an eye patch.
"What do you think of that, then?" said Nobby scornfully. "You think he turned into a bat and flew away?"
"Eh, I do not think that, 'cause it is inconsistent with modern policing," said Detritus.
"Well, I think," said Nobby, "that when you have ruled out the impossible, what is left, however improbable, ain't worth hanging around on a cold night wondering about when you could be getting on the outside of a big drink. Come on, I want to try a leg of the elephant that bit me."
"Was that irony?"
"That was metaphor."
Detritus, uneasy in what was technically his mind, prodded at the torn pieces of clothing. Something brushed against his leg. It was a cat. It had tattered ears, one good eye, and a face like a fist with fur on it.
"Hello, little cat,"
said Detritus. The cat stretched and grinned.
"Get lost, copper."
Detritus blinked. There are no such things as troll cats, and Detritus had never seen a cat before he'd arrived in Ankh Morpork and discovered that they were very, very hard to eat. And he'd never heard of them talking. On the other hand, he was very much aware of his reputation as the most stupid person in the city, and he wasn't going to draw attention to a talking cat if it were going to turn out that everybody except him knew that they talked all the time. In the gutter, a few feet away, there was something white. He picked it up carefully. It looked like the mask the ghost had worn. This was probably a clue. He waved it urgently.
"Hey, Nobby!"
"Thank you."
Something dipped through the darkness, snatched the mask from the troll's hand, and soared into the night. Corporal Nobbs turned around.
"Yes?"
he said.
How big are birds, normally?"
"Oh, blimey, I don't know. Some are small, some are big, who cares?"
Detritus sucked his finger.
"Oh, no reason," he said. "I am far too smart to be taken in by perfectly normal things."